been on wars we fight, driving by the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man, you walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning within the European heartland. Here is the latest attack on our European white traditions, and it comes from British Columbia. And it's entitled, it's from our Red Star, well actually it's the Toronto Star, but and it's called the History Catches Up with a Kamigata Maru villain. Now, the Kamigata Maru was a shipload of mostly Sikh illegals that came to British Columbia, Vancouver, British Columbia in the spring of 1914. This was organized by a radical Sikh group that involved itself in terrorism to try to smuggle these people into Canada, or to test Canada's immigration regulations. And in the end, they were, with the exception of a few who had some legitimate reason to be here, were deported. This, of course, has ever since been a sore point with radical Sikhs who now want us to, well, it actually succeeded in persuading two successive governments, the Conservatives and then later the Liberals, to apologize and even give them some money, to apologize for enforcing our laws. Well, here's the latest attack on our traditions. In recent years, various Canadian government bodies and institutions have erected monuments and renamed buildings commemorating historical figures who contributed to, they claim here the cultural genocide of Canada's Indigenous people, but these were colonial times, and Sir John A. Macdonald, the founder of our country, Hector Louis Langevin, Edward Cornwallis, Louis Trutch, and Matthew Begbie, men who were proponents of residential schools have all been scrubbed off. Plaques and statues are mothballs. Clearly, these complex individuals or men of their times merited a historical reputation downgrade and or some form of legacy asterisking. Whether they deserve further amendment or even censure, however, is problematic. Well, that's this person's. This absolute witch, Carla Qualtrough, she's a federal minister. Today we are announcing the removal of Harriet Stevens' name from a federal public building in Vancouver. We use this as an opportunity to honor and pay respect to the victims of the Komagata Maru in episode. Harry Stevens was a Vancouver member of parliament who very strongly helped organize and pressure the government of the day to enforce the immigration laws. Well, of course, because that involved keeping out a boatload of Sikh illegals, he now is a villain. Trump says, but if there's any Canadian figure who merits historical censure as nearly as possible as that is to defend, thanks to Orwell, it's the latest fully deserving figure of H.H. Stevens. At a news event Friday morning, Federal Minister of Public Services, Carla Qualtrough, and Minister of Defense, he's a Sikh, Harjit Sajjan, announced the removal of Henry Herbert Stevens' name from a federal public building at 125 10th Avenue in Vancouver. The building will not be renamed, but in the spirit of Indigenous reconciliation, the ministers recognized a newly painted mural on the building as symbolic of reconciliation. It's a bunch of, Indian art. Unlike his peers in the pantheon of Canadian villainy, Stevens placed no boundaries on the scalps of Indigenous people. It might be said this was in reference to Lord Cornwallis. The Native Indians, both sides, the Native Indians scalped whites. So, this was fighting fire with fire in the spirit of the times. Stevens' crime against humanity were committed against Sikh and Punjabi immigrants and had no limited in his limited historical contribution. He held various cabinet postings and also a short stint as the chairman of the Vancouver Board of Trade later in his life. Was in helping close the doors on Asian immigration in the first half of the 20th century. He didn't commit any crimes against them. In 1914, Harry Stevens was a member of parliament from the Vancouver during the Komagata Maru incident. And at the time, he was the loudest voice, they say white supremacy, but basically just preserving the white people on the coast, whipping up mobs and hysteria to support the government in turning away the Komagata Maru. Now, this wasn't, didn't whip up a mob. Even a century ago, Stevens' rhetoric was extremist, even though it was in the era of race politics, when miscegenation laws were still in force in the U.S., and our politicians and newspapers openly advocated for Canada being a white man's country. Well, that was what people felt. A further betrayal of our people, and this is Harry Stevens was a extremely good representative of his people, and he reflected the feelings of the time, and he reflected a desire to maintain British Columbia is predominantly white, and it was a matter of enforcing the law. Now, of course, we have illegals pouring into the country. The Sikhs agitated for a number of years with our increasingly weakened political leadership in this country, for Paul and Apology, and they end up getting it, both from liberals and conservatives. They deserve no apology. They claimed, of course, it was a wound that the community had trouble dealing with, trouble enduring. And I say, as the English do, that's just so much bollocks or nonsense. Absolute nonsense. I'll tell you what. There were relatively few Sikhs in Canada up until the 1980s. Some had come before the First World War. And after that, there was almost an end to Asiatic immigration beginning in the 70s, I guess. But since then, they have absolutely poured in from the Punjab, many of them members of radical organizations, some of which are involved in terrorist activities in Britain, in India, and some of which, bombed two Canadian planes, set bombs on an Air India plane that blew up, killing 376 people, and on a Canadian Pacific plane, fly to India, which would have blown up had it been on time. The luggage was it was late. The luggage was unloaded, and the luggage blew up at the airport in Narita, Japan, killing two Japanese baggage handlers. But had it blown up as planned by the Sikh terrorists, it would have killed a couple of hundred people. Anyway, but for all their caterwauling and complaining, hordes and hordes of Sikhs had emigrated to Canada, despite what their community leaders say. This is a terrible wound to their national to their national pride. Well, it's all nonsense. Of course, it's nonsense. You would think, well, if it really was, that they wouldn't come, would they? You know, they just say, well, this is, the insult is just too grievous. We won't come to Canada. Well, that, of course they don't say that. It's all hooey. This is a very in-depth thought piece about a very evil man, Count Richard Coudenhove Kalergi. And he was in many ways the architect of the European Union and a sinister plan. This wasn't a political, it wasn't primarily a political plan or a, it wasn't primarily a political semi-union or economic union. That's the way it was sold. But it was fundamentally a long-range plan to destroy the nationalities of Europe and replace them with one government and a mixed mongrel race. Now, that only became clear in the last couple of decades. See, originally, the European Union was sold to the masses as, well, a way to reduce trade barriers and some other restrictions, maybe to harmonize things in sort of common standards, and up to a point, it might make some sense. But that wasn't the long-range goal. What was far more sinister than that. The long-range goal was the end of nationality. So no more French, no more Germans, no more Englishmen, and that there would be a new European man. And the new European man, according to this evil manipulator, was going to be a mixed race of African and Asian. And he would look like, he saw it, he was wrong anthropologically, but he would look like, the new man would look like the ancient Egyptians. And the new moral aristocracy of this European nightmare would be Jews. They would be the moral aristocracy. Well, now, this plan was backed by major Jewish financiers, including the Rothschilds, and the Warburgs in the United States. And because he was very well connected, Count Richard Coudenhove Kalergi was closely associated with the Habsburg monarchy and other people. He had good contacts. He was able to push these ideas over a number of decades. But the long-range goal is what we are now seeing in Europe. Basically, the white people being replaced. Called genocide. Europe has a long and bloody history. Empires have risen and fallen. Wars have repeatedly redefined national borders. And the human cost has been untold amounts of death and suffering. Today, however, there are no wars within Europe, and we are all apparently united in diversity. The motto of the European Union since 2000 has three short words tell us exactly what we should think. No doubt, no expense was spared in hiring a top PR firm to come up with this nifty-sounding Orwellian slogan that, in true Big Brother fashion, works to brainwash the masses into believing we truly are stronger together. Many heads are better than one scenario. And this is a really good essay. This is called The Kalergi's Baby, the Hydra that is the European Union. Rewind almost 3,000 years to the first account of the mythological hero Heracles, or Hercules, who was tasked with 12 labors by Hera in the hope that he would be defeated and killed. His second labor was to slay the Hydra, a many-headed serpentine creature that was raised by Hera to kill Heracles, and which lived in the Lake of Lerna near the entrance to the underworld. Heracles, however, proved too wily for the Hydra, using strength and ingenuity and the assistance of his nephew Iolaus. Heracles decapitated each head until none were left and the Hydra was dead. While the mythical creature will only ever be such, the metaphorical many-headed Hydra is alive and thriving in the form of the European Union today. He makes the comment the European Union Parliament resembles the Tower of Babel, or Babel from the Bible. And this is a very interesting and very detailed message. Or essay on this, and so I'm going to just get back to here. For a moment, let's take a shorter trip back in time. The 1920s, when Hemingway was living and traveling in Europe, with each country still sovereign and its people unique. Hemingway experienced life in Paris as very different to that in Pamplona, that was in Spain, of course. The Italians, unlike the Austrians, and each border crossing a doorway to a unique combination of landscape, language, customs, and food. That's what, you know, the real diversity of Europe was. While Hemingway was busy hanging out with his writerly and socialite friends, an Austro-Japanese man named Count Richard von Coudenhove Kalergi, co-founder of the Pan-European Union with Archduke Otto von Habsburg in 1922. Both were Freemasons. The following year, Kalergi published the manifesto Pan-Europa, in which he writes, now, "The biggest obstacle to the accomplishment of the United States of Europe is the 1,000-years-old rivalry between the two most populated nations of Pan-Europe, Germany and France." After reading Pan-Europa, German-Jewish banker and Freemason Max Warburg contacted fellow Freemason Baron Louis de Rothschild, who's also Jewish, to facilitate an introduction to Kalergi, a meeting that resulted in Warburg donating 60,000 gold marks to finance the movement for 3 years. This was just the beginning of 1924. A year later, in 1925, Warburg arranged for Kalergi to travel to the United States to meet his brother Paul Warburg and Jewish-American financier Bernard Baruch, who was also very closely tied with the political system, including President Wilson, or Wilson by this time is dead. But the same year, Kalergi published Praktischer Idealismus, or Practical Idealism. Marian Mihaila, assistant to the Grand Master of Romanian Masonry, writes in the autumn 2006 issue of the Masonic Forum magazine, Kalergi was encouraged and financed by a series of American Masons who want to create thus, according to the American model, the first Masonic state in history, the United States of Europe. An interesting side note is that Max Warburg's funding of Pan-Europa came just 7 years after he worked with Kaiser Wilhelm II and the German High Command to orchestrate Lenin's return to Russia in a sealed train in April 1917. Lenin and his fellow exiles on the train were carrying $6 million in gold to finance the overthrow of the provisional government. Don't forget there had been a revolution, a vaguely social democratic revolution, and they were still struggling to figure out how to govern France, and they were quite disorganized and divided. Meanwhile, the communists were disciplined, organized, and well-funded, and in the end, they took over and prevailed, and you know, as they say, the rest is history. Paul Warburg's brother-in-law, Jacob Schiff, a Jewish-American banker and head of New York investment firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company, was one of the principal financiers of the Bolshevik Revolution, donating $20 million to the cause and funding Leon Trotsky's return passage to Russia in March 1917. Trotsky was a Ukrainian Jew who was born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, and he was a violent revolutionary, and he for a while led the Russian army, the Soviet army. Thus, in the early 20th century, the capitalists of Wall Street not only funded a movement to unite all Western European countries, they also funded communism, which, as we know, united all Eastern European countries under the Soviet Union. In 1923, Trotsky wrote an article for Pravda, that was the Soviet newspaper, entitled, "Is the time ripe for the slogan, the United States of Europe?" in which he states, "Europe will be able not only to maintain itself, but to consolidate and build herself up once she has broken down the customs barriers and has united herself economically to the inexhaustible natural riches of Russia. The United States of Europe, a purely revolutionary perspective, is the next stage of our generally revolutionary perspective." In addition to Kalergi being supported by Jewish bankers, he was also supported by Austrian Freemasons. An article in the 1925 edition of the Masonic magazine, The Beacon, reads, "Freemasonry, especially Austrian Freemasonry, may be eminently satisfied to have Kuhnhof Kalergi among its members." He was a Freemason. "Austrian Freemasonry can rightly report that Brother Kuhnhof Kalergi's fights for his pan-European beliefs. Brother Kalergi's program is a Masonic work of the highest order, and to be able to work on it together is a lofty task for all Brother Masons." Kalergi had joined the Masonic Lodge in Vienna in 1921. Freemasons were also working on another front toward a united Europe. In September 1929, Freemason Aristide Briand, the French Foreign Affairs Minister, gave a speech at the League of Nations in which he proposed the establishment of a federal European Union. The basis of his plan was economic, but his fundamental aim was political union. Since Kalergi moved in aristocratic and political circles, his ideas attracted European heads of state as supporters and collaborators, as well as known figures such as Sigmund Freud, the author Thomas Mann, and Albert Einstein, all Freemasons. In 1926, the first Pan-Europa meeting took place in Vienna with 2,000 attendees. At this meeting, Kalergi was elected as president of the General Council, a position he held for 49 years until his death in 1972. He was succeeded by Otto von Habsburg. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported on the meeting as follows. "Several Jewish European leaders took a prominent part in the first Pan-European Congress, which opened here on Sunday, when the movement to establish a United States of Europe, modeled after the United States of America, took definite shape. Many individual European Jews are furthering the Pan-European movement by giving it financial support. Count Kuttenhope Kalergi, who is married to Ida Roland, a Jewess, and this is from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. When interviewed by the representative of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, he expressed his opinion that the Pan-European movement ought to find particular support on the part of the Jews who are scattered throughout various countries in Europe. The creation of the United States of Europe would be beneficial to the Jews as it would eliminate racial hatred and economic rivalry, he said. Now, you know, there's the old anti-racism thing. I find this a very, very interesting essay, in which I'm going to continue. This is about Kuttenhope Kalergi. The architect of the diabolical European Union plan. You see, the long-range plan isn't just an economic lessening of barriers, which might even be okay, but basically the replacement of the European people by a new man, a new European man who will be mixed race. This is the diabolical plan. When Hemingway left Europe to return to the United States in 1928, Kalergi pushed forward with his pan-European vision, proposing Beethoven's Ode to Joy as the European anthem, and it became that with the European Union. That was in 1929. And that there be an annual designated Europe Day that was proposed in 1930. Beyond these two suggestions being adopted by the current European Union, Kalergi's influence on not only its formation, but also on its shape cannot be understated. His original vision was for a world divided into only five states, the United States of Europe that would link continental countries with French and Italian possessions in Africa, a pan-American Union encompassing North and South Americas, the British Commonwealth circling the globe, the USSR expanding Eurasia, and a Pan-Asian Union whereby Japan and China would control most of the Pacific. Now, in many cases, these would not be happy unions. The Japanese and the Chinese have a long and traditional rivalry. Latin America would not be particularly amenable to being a part of a union with North America. But anyway, these were his ideas. The movement toward this vision picked up pace following World War II, drawing international support from Winston Churchill, from Winston Churchill to Harry Truman, both 33 third degree Masons. It's very interesting, you know. Winston Churchill, superficially hardcore Englishman, but the appearances are deceptive. In December 1945, Kalergi penned an article that was published in Collier's magazine in the United States. Truman, impressed with the ideas expressed, adopted a policy of promotion of this idea of the United States of Europe. You know, and there goes national sovereignty. To this end, the American Committee on United Europe was created in 1948 with William Donovan, wartime head of the Office of Strategic Services, precursor of the CIA, appointed as chairman, and Alan Dulles, who would become CIA director from 1953 to 61, vice president. The American Committee for United Europe heavily financed the European movement, with covert funding being funneled through the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. Behind the scenes, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a conspiratorial globalist group in Washington, and the Bilderberg Group also backed a United Europe, with the former supporting the idea of a single currency as early as 1955. And indeed, there would be, not perfectly, but eventually a more or less single European currency, which would be the euro. Meanwhile, back in Europe, during a speech in Zurich in September 1946, Churchill called for a United States of Europe. He said, "We must build a kind of United States of Europe. Much work has been done upon this task by the exertions of the Pan-European Union, which owes so much to Count Kutnov-Kalergi. The structure of the United States of Europe, if well and truly built, will be such as to make the material strength of a single state less important. Small nations will count as much as large ones and gain their honor by their contribution to the common cause. The first step is to form a Council of Europe. If at first all the states of Europe are not willing or able to join the Union, we must nevertheless proceed to assemble and combine those who will and those who can." Now, you know, he was practical. He realized that it would take a long time and a lot of misinformation and disguise of the fact that this would be the death of national sovereignty. And it would take a while for all the European unions to come around to joining. And they still haven't. For instance, Switzerland has not joined. But less than a year later, Kalergi founded the European Parliamentary Union in July 1947. The European Parliamentary Union, along with the European Movement, founded the same year by Churchill's son-in-law, Duncan Sandys, played a leading role in the Congress of The Hague in May 1948. However, the European Movement eclipsed the European Parliamentary Union in significance when it founded the Council of Europe in 1949, one of the current seven major institutions of the European Union today. In 1950, the European Union merged with the European Movement, and Kalergi was elected as honorary president in 1952. The same year, Jean Monnet, president of the High Authority of the European Coal and Steel Community, now the European Commission, from 1952 to 55, wrote the following in a letter to a friend: "Europe's nations should be guided toward the superstate without their people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps, each disguised as having an economic purpose, but which will eventually and irresistibly lead to federation." You see, staying right out clearly, the conspiratorial and deceptive nature of all of this, the peoples are to be kept in the dark, and measures will be presented as economic, you know, economic cooperation. Well, you know, naturally, of course, cooperation is better than conflict, but it was far more complicated than that, and far more devious. The Treaty of Lisbon, which came into effect in December 2009, was the culmination of the conspiracy to achieve superstate by stealth. While the cogs are still moving to bring every nation fully under the control of the European Union, the treaty, containing the components of the unratified European Constitution of 2004 under a more palatable name, is a blueprint for consolidation of power in the hands of the unelected few. Crucially, it strips the power of veto from national governments while bonding all countries to comply with and implement policy passed by those same unelected few. And it's one of the major reasons there was so much support in Britain as people began to realize this for Brexit. I'm trying to find this again here. The European Union superstate is, however, a stepping stone to world government. Paul Warburg's son, James, speaking at the United States Senate in February 1950, said, "We shall have world government, whether we like it or not. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent." I mean, there's a totalitarian vision. James Warburg's statement is an extension of Kalergi's vision to consolidate the entire world into five states. Within just 10 years following the end of the Second World War, Kalergi's early initiative to establish a united Europe had gained enormous international support and funding, both of which spawned yet more initiatives, movements, and organizations, something which was to become the defining nature of the European Union we know today. Currently, there are 7 primary institutions of the European Union: the European Parliament, the European Council, the Council of the European Union, the European Commission, the Court of Justice of the European Union, composed of 3 courts, the Court of Justice, the General Court, and Civil Service Tribunal, the European Central Bank, composed of the Executive Board, the Governing Council, the Council, General Council, and the Supervisory Board, and the Court of Auditors. On top of these 7 primary institutions and their offshoots are presently 48 agencies composed of 37 decentralized agencies, 6 executive agencies, 2 Euratom, that's European Atomic Energy Community Agencies, and anyway, without ticking them all off, there's a long list of these people. There are 2 consultative committees, the Economic and Social Committee and the Committee on the Regions, plus the European Investment Bank. In addition, there are 3 interinstitutional bodies: the Publications Office, the European Personnel Selection Office, and the European Administrative School, and the European Anti-Fraud Office. Next up is the European Civil Service, composed of 34 directorates general, which serves the European Commission. Head spinning yet? Aside from the enormous costs involved in maintaining this bureaucracy, from employee salaries and expenses to overheads on 98 European Union buildings in Brussels and Strasbourg, thousands and thousands of reams of paper have been generated to document the 120,000 or so regulations that comprise European law, which significantly trumps the national law of each country within the European Union. Article 288 of the Treaty of the Functioning of the European Union reads, "To exercise the Union's competences, the institutions shall adopt regulations, directives, decisions, recommendations, and opinions. A regulation shall have general application. It shall be binding on its entirety and directly applicable to all member states. A directive shall be binding as to the result to be achieved upon each member state to which it's addressed, but shall leave to the national authorities the choice of forms and methods." And there's more, but reportedly, if one were to stack the paperwork for all current European Union rules and regulations, they would reach the top of the Nelson's Column in London. In other words, 51.6 meters, which is about 55 yards, like half a football field of paper. Let's say each ream is approximately 6 centimeters tall. This would amount to 860 reams, or 430,000 pages of regulations. In 2006, Soviet dissident Vladimir Bukovsky, in a speech in Brussels, had this to say about the European Union regulations: "When you look into all this bizarre activity of the European Union, with its 80,000 pages of regulations, it looks like Ghost Plan, the Soviet Union's planning committee, an organization which was planning everything in the country to the last nut and bolt 5 years in advance, but of course it failed." Bukowski further draws parallels between the Soviet Union and the European Union, likening the European Parliament to the Supreme Soviet and the European Commission to the Politburo. I'm very carefully watching such structures as Europol, for example. They will have to police us on 32 kinds of crime, 2 of which are particularly worrying. One is called racism, another is xenophobia. Someone from the British government told us that those who object to uncontrolled immigration from the Third World will be regarded as racists, and those who oppose further European integration will be regarded as xenophobes. See, so like, if you're a nationalist, if you believe in independent, in national sovereignty, you could, you were really a thought criminal. If you go through, Bukowski said this, if you go through all the structures and features of this emerging European monster, you will notice that it is more and more that more and more resembles the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, they are introducing more and more ideology. The Soviet Union used to be a state run by ideology. Today's ideology of the European Union is social democratic, statist, and a big part of what is political correctness. I watch very carefully how political correctness spreads and becomes an oppressive ideology. What Bukowski says about racism, xenophobia, and political correctness couldn't be more relevant today, as the manufactured migrant crisis engulfs Europe and its countries, dividing people from Spain to Hungary. Exactly as Bukowski warned, those who don't agree with further immigration are now being painted as racist and or xenophobic, often being referred to as extremist fascists or Nazis, or neo-Nazis, I should say. There is little in the way of rational discourse of the full implication of increased immigration. Meanwhile, mainstream media and politicians are quick to scaremonger about the danger of the extreme right. I'm going to continue this tomorrow. This is a kind of a long thought piece. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on ResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break now. I'm going to play some tunes from, these are Ulster Scots folk tunes. And, of course, the Ulster Scots played a very significant role in the settlement of the United States and Canada and Australia. And, of course, especially in Appalachia. You'll recognize some of these tunes. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
We're a people true and proud, sing with pride and sing aloud, Northern Ireland. you wonder why I am so proud. You wonder why I sing so loud. Try and change this whole world way to turn and out and know the way.
We're
people true and proud. Sing with pride and sing with love.
Lord Ireland, Lord Ireland, I will.
People true and proud.
Sing with pride and sing with love.
There are sailor boys on the seven seas. Lovers.
fields all alone. Down by the banks of Knockaren, where beauty and pleasure were known, I spied a fair maid at her labors, which caused me to stay for a while. I thought of her goddess of beauty, that blooming bright star of bright Isle. I humbled myself to her beauty. Fair maiden, where do you belong? From heaven descended, abided in Cupid's fair throne. Young man, I will tell you a secret. It's true, I'm a maid that is poor. And to part from my vows and my promise is more than my heart can endure. Therefore, I'll remain at my service and go through all my hardships and toil. And wait for the lad that has left me all alone on the banks of their life. Young maiden, I wish not to banter. 'Tis true, I come here in disguise. I came here to fulfill my last promise and hoped to view a surprise. All I know is you're a maid I love dearly, and you've been in my heart all the while. For me, there is no other damsel than my blooming bright star of fair Isle. For me, there is no other damsel than my blooming bright star of fair Isle.
Well, there are some Ulster folk tunes. And this is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose entwined, the maple leaf forever. Yeah. maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.